Yes, today's Easter. And after today, we have just 2 more weeks in the Gospel of Luke. Can you believe it? An entire year has gone by since I started this project of preaching the Gospel of Luke front to back, beginning to end. And I know for me how quickly it's gone by, and for you, for some of you, it only feels like a decade. But yes, 2 more weeks, and we are done. And just so you know, for Advent, I'm preaching from the book of Isaiah, Old Testament prophecy of Isaiah, just for something different. So, as I do each week, as I prepared this text, I pondered that question. What is it that Luke is teaching his people with this particular story? Remember, Luke was writing his gospel for his congregation, which was about 40 or 50 years after Jesus' life and death. And Luke has compiled these stories and teachings of Jesus to teach his own congregation, not just about Jesus, but how to be disciples, followers of Jesus. And there is a crucial distinction between the facts of Jesus' life and the call to discipleship. And we find this distinction presented in the Easter reading today. Our reading begins with the story of a man named Joseph. Joseph is described as being a good and righteous man. He was a native of a Jewish town known as Arimathea, but he was now a resident in Jerusalem and a member of the ruling Jewish council in that city, the council that we call the Sanhedrin. And this is the same council that argued for Jesus' execution before Pilate. Luke points out that Joseph did not agree with the actions of the council. In fact, we are told Joseph was waiting expectantly for the kingdom of God. Clearly, Joseph is someone who is in tune with Jesus' message of the kingdom. Now, following Jesus' crucifixion, a story we looked at last week, Joseph does something unusual. He goes to Pilate and requests Jesus' body. The bodies of the crucified were normally left on the cross for days or more as a warning to those who might cross the Roman Empire. However, Jewish law, as we find in the book of Deuteronomy, requires that a crucified body of a criminal be buried before sundown, because these people are a curse on the land and they need to be put away. Joseph is described by Luke as being a good and righteous man. And when we read these words, I am reminded of 2 other people that we encountered at the beginning of Jesus' life. If you recall, when Jesus' parents take him to Jerusalem, to the temple for his dedication, 2 people appear. One was Simeon, and the other was Anna. Both are described as being prophets and being righteous. They are people that were regarded highly within the community. And both of them independently take this infant and declare that he will be special for the people of Israel. And here at the end of Jesus' life, we have Joseph, also a good and righteous man, who is taking Jesus' body to care for it. Now, when bodies were taken from a cross, they were most likely just placed in a common grave. These were criminals, weren't they? But it's interesting to note the care and respect that those close to Jesus give to his corpse. Joseph puts his reputation on the line by going to Pilate with the request, because no respectable citizen goes and asks for the body of a criminal. But Joseph's request is granted by Pilate, and he has the body taken down from the cross. It is wrapped in a linen cloth and placed in a rock-hewn tomb where no body has been placed before. And here we find in that statement an echo of the description of the donkey that Jesus rode into Jerusalem. If you recall, that was a colt that had never been ridden. So, on Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, he rides the colt that has never been ridden. But on his way out of Jerusalem, he's placed in a tomb in which no one has been laid. Jesus' death took place on the day before the Jewish Sabbath. We say it was a Friday. And the day before the Sabbath was known as the day of preparation because that was when people prepared for the Sabbath. Next, we meet the women in the story. And these women have been introduced to us earlier in chapter 8. They are Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and some others. Back in chapter 8, Luke tells us that Mary Magdalene had been exorcised of 7 demons. Joanna is the wife of a steward, a servant of Herod. And these women and others had been followers of Jesus since he was in Galilee. And they were also, we are told, financial supporters of his ministry. On the day that Jesus was placed in the tomb, they followed Joseph and his people and go to the tomb themselves to check on the body, make sure it is properly arranged. And then they leave because they need to gather spices and ointments in order to prepare the body for a proper burial, because it's going to have to just wait there until the Sabbath is over. I'm sure it's getting late in the day and they've got work to do because they cannot work on the Sabbath day. So they gather the ointments and spices that they need. They rest on the Sabbath day, and then on the first day of the week, early at dawn, they go to the tomb. They come to the tomb, and when they get there, they discover that the stone that was placed over the door has been pushed back, and that the door to the tomb is open. And when they look in the tomb, there is no body there. And while they stand there trying to figure all of this out, 2 men in dazzling clothes are standing next to them. And the women are terrified, because the last time we saw someone in dazzling clothes, it was Jesus up on the mountain at the Transfiguration. And so these are clearly divine beings, angels, messengers of God. And the men ask the women, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen." And they continue saying, "Remember how he told you, while he was still in Galilee, that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified, and on the third day rise again." And with those words, the women did remember. And they return to the 11 disciples, and they tell them what they've seen. And to the disciples, we are told, all of this sounds like an idle tale. That's our translation. Really, a better word is nonsense. It sounded like nonsense to them, and they did not believe them. But Peter runs to the tomb and checks it out and discovers that, yes, what they said is true, and he is amazed. That is the Easter story as presented by Luke. It's a simple, straightforward account. It leaves out some of the flourishes that we find in the other accounts. For example, Mark tells us that it was an earthquake that moved the stone. And in this story, did you notice there's no Jesus? There's no Jesus to talk to Mary. We see that in the Gospel of John. So what we have in our head is a harmonizing of all these gospel accounts of the empty tomb, the resurrection. But Luke, pretty straightforward. The women go there, the tomb is empty, and 2 men speak to them and ask why they're looking for the living among the dead. Now, back at the beginning of this gospel, a passage I've referred to often, Luke informs his readers that his intent is to write an orderly account, But the purpose of this orderly account is that people might learn the truth concerning these things, as he describes it. And these things is Jesus' life. Luke's orderly account pertains the pertinent facts of Jesus' life. And Luke has collected these facts from stories about Jesus that were circulating through the Christian communities, from other written reports of Jesus' life, and no doubt from eyewitnesses themselves, because not that much time has gone by. And what Luke offers us in this gospel is more than just the facts of the case. Because he's not giving us a history lesson, although he's very good at historical details. Luke is teaching his people not just about Jesus, but how they in turn can be followers, disciples of Jesus Christ. And a disciple we see here is not just someone who can recite the facts of Jesus' life. No. A disciple believes the truth. The truth that Jesus was God's son, that Jesus could perform deeds of power, that he could heal, that he could forgive people of their sins, that he introduced us to the image of the kingdom of God. To believe in Jesus means more than just knowing what happened in his life, but it means to have a living faith, a faith that grows and breathes and changes within us. Now, the opposite of a living faith is not a dead faith, but it really is a static faith, an unchanging faith. I think, for example, of an historical figure like Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was president of the United States. He's from Tennessee. His home was in Hermitage, not very far from here. There have been books and books written about Andrew Jackson, some from people who live locally. We know a lot about Andrew Jackson. We have all the facts about his life that we might want. But we're not disciples of Andrew Jackson. Yes, we can tell you when he was born and what he did and where all those facts. But that doesn't make us disciples. Joseph of Arimathea, for example, has this living faith. We see it in his desire for the kingdom of God. When the women go to the tomb, the angels say something that's very interesting. Because what I believe that they do in that account is they give the women a key to a living faith. Yes, they may have known Jesus, they believed in Jesus, but remember when they got there, they couldn't seem to remember. And the angels ask, remember what he said to you. And when they say that, the women do. They remember. It's like that's a key that opens their hearts, opens their faith, opens their eyes. In the next story we'll look at next week is the story of the two disciples who have given up on everything and they're going home on that road to Emmaus. And who should join them on the road but Jesus? But they don't recognize him until they sit down for the meal and Jesus says the words of communion. Words that we will use here. Do this in remembrance of me. And their eyes were opened. That becomes a key. This active remembering. A month ago at communion, I talked about how communion is a remembrance, not just of what has happened in the past, but it is an active involvement of what is happening now, and it points to what we will do in the future, the kingdom of God. So remembering, not just the facts, but involved in a living faith, a faith that is unlocked by the power of God, the power of the Spirit moving through us. Today, we are remembering the saints of the church through All Saints Day. All Saints Day is not just a day to remember those who have died in the past year, those who were members of our church, those who we were close to, but it's a time to remember all the saints of all time. For as Presbyterians, we don't look upon saints as just being those people that the Catholic Church has canonized, But all those people of faith who have gone before, the millions upon millions, names that have been long forgotten, but it's as if we're sitting in a vast stadium surrounded by this cloud of witnesses. And when we gather at the communion table and we hear the words of Jesus, "Do this in remembrance of me," we know that we are part of the cloud of witness, part of the communion of saints, that they are all there with us, a living faith that continues through this day and into the next. Today, we celebrate Easter. And as I told the kids, every Sunday is an Easter, for every Sunday is that day that we celebrate that Christ is alive. We may not see him there at the tomb, but we will see him walking with us through our lives, opening up our hearts that we too might have a faith that is alive. And for this we can give thanks.